I'd like to convene the finance committee. We just received a quorum on the approval of the January 21st minutes. You got 21st and the 28th. So, Smith, you were here studying the minutes, weren't you?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, so moved.
We got 21st. Okay, Representative Smith moved the payroll minutes for January 21st, 2009. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Mr. Murphy, would you care to move the minutes for January the 28th? Have you got a chance to study these?
I'll move the approval of the minutes as they're printed.
That motion is before us for the 28th. Any discussion? Seeing none, or hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Our first bill this morning is House File 117 by Representative Goldberg. That's the efficiency bill. And perhaps, Mr. Benson, when it gets to you, people have a long history of seeing you before various committees with the Department of Corrections. So after you might want to
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 117 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Solberg is here to explain the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is the deficiency bill, and it's the bill that comes to us from the administration. I know there are lots of people probably in the audience or other agencies that would like to be included in a deficiency bill and say, well, fund my program. I'm short of money this particular year. But in negotiating with the department over the years, we've made sure that it is in true a need that needs to be addressed before June 30th of 2009, this fiscal year that we're in, that is stuff that cannot wait, and it's very narrowly drafted all the time. So there's only two proposals within the deficiency bill. One of them is for $1.060 to match a FEMA grant that takes place as a result of the flooding in, I think, six counties. And the counties are Cook, in way in northeastern Minnesota, Maurer, Fillmore, Freeborn, Houston, and Nobles counties. So it's two flooding incidences in the state of Minnesota. I did check with the chair of the committee on Mr. Paymar on that, and I think he's comfortable with this going forward without having this go before his particular committee. The other major part of this is the deficiency is $16 million. That is appropriated to the Department of Human Services for state-operated services, Minnesota Sex Offenders Program. There was an extensive hearing in Representative Huntley's committee on that issue, not with the bill in front of him, but on the issue. We have Dennis Benson, who you mentioned before, is with us to give us a brief rundown, I say brief, in that will give us the reason why this particular issue is before us in this fiscal year. We also have, if there are any questions on the first part, John Kerr is the Deputy Director of Homeland Security for the state, to answer any questions on the first part of the bill. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would turn it over to Mr. Benson for a brief explanation of that part.
Okay, and you're going to walk us through I think we have copies of the handout here as well, so we'll have it both on the screen and people can follow with the handout. Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I've been in this position since last March 6th. With me is Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director, who may be able to answer questions should you have them. I will try to go through this very quickly. What we're trying to do with this PowerPoint is simply tell a story in terms of how we ended up with a $16 million deficit. I know in times like this, this is not the news that you would like to hear, but I think we've got some pretty compelling rationale why we ended up in the predicament that we have. The first slide is just basically what we're going to go through here, the deficiency and reduction efforts, budget appropriations. We did a transfer. We're also in the middle of building a 400-bed building up at the Moose Lake facility, and that construction has been delayed, which is really the primary driver of the deficiency request. We are also partnering with Department of Corrections, renting space from them, have been for the last almost 3 years now, so that is another driver. Basically, MSOP is comprised of three different locations, two of them up at the Moose Lake facility. We have beds in the old, what we call the PP hospital, and then MSOP is renting 200 beds from the prison. You know, we refer to that as the annex. And then we have about 175 down at St. Peter. So we have over 500 now civil commits in our program. Again, it became apparent to us last April that we had a significant problem. We were on a trajectory to run about a $25 million deficit, and we have taken lots of steps to reduce that number. And as we sit here today, that number is at about exactly $16 million based on a fair amount of spending history now. We think we can get through the fiscal year with $16 million additional dollars. To get that number from 24 or 25 to 16, we've held about over 150 positions open. We're doing that at a time when we've added about 90 patients now. We've reduced overtime, administrative costs, contract costs, one-time costs. We've separated our budget from the state-operated services budget so that we have more control, and we put in purchasing safeguards as well. So we've dropped it by about $9 million. This next slide, you can kind of get some history of what the MSOP-based budget looked like, and I'll give you more explanation here in just a moment, but the slide in the lower right-hand corner gives you some perspective of the dramatic growth that has occurred in MSOP. Back in 2006, when the building that we're going to be moving in July was bonded, it was thought by DHS that they would be able to save about $7.4 million through efficiencies once they got into the new building.
Representative House indicated he had a question. Did you?
I could ask a question now.
You want to ask it now or okay. Representative House?
I have the fiscal note here, and it says that 10% of the appropriation will be offset by collections and payments from counties for the civilly committed. Is this 10% new and unexpected monies from the county, or is this money that the counties are already aware of that they're going to be paying for the remainder of the biennium?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hollis, yes, that is money that they're aware of. That's their 10% of the civil commit hold cost.
Mr. Chair, just in my opening remarks, we need to appropriate the $15 million. The actual cost, or $16 million, the actual cost of the state is somewhat less than, about $1.6 million less.
Okay, thank you. If you want to continue, then,
Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair and members, this next slide, again, we became aware of our problem a year ago. We had to actually borrow $8 million from fiscal year 9 to complete fiscal year 8 in the red. We have rider language authority that permits us to do this. So we started the year with a $54.5 million budget, so we actually knew about this problem late last year in terms of legislative session, and then again did whatever we could to try to lower that number. This next slide is basically the construction issue, and when this building was initially bonded, it was thought that they could be into the new building by July of 2008. Then it was changed to October of 2008. Later, it was determined that the completion date would be March of 2009. And then when I came on board last March, the date I heard was October of 2009. Mm-hmm. We've got that date now rolled back to actually April. We should hope to get April 30th. We hope to get possession of the building. It usually takes a good 30, 45 days to clean it up, work the bugs out, so occupancy would be July of 2009. I tell you all of this for two reasons. Number one, again, the efficiencies are not coming to bear in this biennial budget. When it was indicated in the budget request that there would be a savings of $7.479 million that you see at the top of this slide. In addition to that, as I mentioned, we're renting 200 beds from corrections. we struck a deal with them back in 2006 whereby they would move the same number of inmates from the two buildings up at Moose Lake to a privately held facility out in Appleton, Minnesota. The rent cost at that time was about $660,000 a month that we would pay them. They would in turn have to turn around and pay for the placement of these offenders. This was the only viable alternative to manage, again, the unexpected and unprecedented growth of civil commits into the program. So those two numbers, the projected rent cost for fiscal year 2009 was $8.2 million. Again, when the budget was set, they thought that they would be into the new building in October, so they only funded rent to the tune of $2.6 million. The difference is $5.6 million. So between the not achieving the efficiency, 7.4, and the additional rent that we have to pay corrections because they have to pay the private vendor, is $13 million. So that is the bulk of the deficiency request. Quick slide here just showing you the building, where it's at. These pictures were some from fall and some from this winter. We, again, are moving very, very quickly to try to get the new building online. This next slide just basically tracks the...
Representative Briskins has a question. Representative Briskins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if it'd be your pleasure, I'll wait and ask my question once this piece is over.
Maybe it would be a good idea, because it is a short presentation, why don't we just hold on all questions until
gets
done, and then we'll revert back, and you'll be next on the list.
Thank you.
Mr. Benson?
This slide simply tracks the rent, the exchange of dollars from MSOP, the Sex Offender Program, to corrections. That amount was $662 a month. But there will be an increase this month to $736,500 a month for these 200 offenders that have been displaced, and that's a contract cost that increase for corrections that they are simply passing on to us. Again, the 256 inmates that were in those two buildings are now housed at the Prairie Correctional Facility out in Appleton. When we get into the new building, these 256 offenders will come back to the prison and corrections will no longer have to pay that rent bill. So again, that's the crux of the money. Corrections had to pay to displace them. We had to pay corrections because we needed the space. Again, reasons for the deficiency, K building delays, the construction delays, and the renting costs. They did not achieve the efficiencies in the manner in which had first been indicated. We've also had unprecedented growth. there was a scheduling issue with scheduling at three different locations. Remember, we had high visibility escapes from St. Peter back in 2005, 2006, and the problematic patients down at St. Peter were moved up to the two buildings that MSOP was renting from Corrections. So they staffed those buildings up dramatically to prepare for these patients who were treatment non-compliant for the most part. At that time, there was about 50% program participation. Today, there's about 80%. These were difficult patients from a management perspective, and DHS hired a fair number of staff wanting to err on the side of public safety on the heels of these two high visibility escapes. The summary here, basically, our salary budget is already in the negative. We can deficit spend in salaries, but we cannot deficit spend in contract costs like food, medical costs, and so forth. We have to have real cash. So we are in dire straits here in terms of money and managing this difficult-to-manage patient population. If we laid off many, many staff tomorrow, we could not make up this deficit. And as you know, this program is constitutionally compelled to provide treatment, so we simply can't touch treatment staff anyway. 90% of our costs are salary. It's a 24/7 operation. We are the repository. We are working very hard to manage this problem to the extent that we can responsibly, but at some point it becomes a staff safety, patient safety, and public safety issue if we don't have adequate funds to manage this population. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's our story in a nutshell, and we're happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, what is the total cost of this 400 bed unit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buskins, give us a moment here. We'll retrieve that cost. I want to say it's in the area of $60 million, but let me take a moment here and see if we can retrieve that number.
Okay, well, while your staff is looking, maybe you've got a follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of follow-up questions. Mr. Benson, was in the request for the bonds, was the cost of temporarily housing these offenders a part of the bond request?
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buskins, are you talking about the bonding for the facility or the...
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, Mr. Benson, it's Representative Biskins, and yes, I was talking about that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, no, that cost was not included in the bonding request. That was part of the budget request that DHS brought forward.
Thank you. Final question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, I'm assuming that this facility, its construction subject to prevailing wage laws. Was there any calculation as to how much that law added on to the cost of this facility?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, I would have to get back to you on that. I was not present when this facility was bonded. So what I do understand, though, is the costs have come in at a reasonable level for construction for this facility.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll revert back when you get that other information on his first question. In the meantime, Representative Hausman will be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine is more comment looking to the future. We know that this program has only growth in its future, and we're wondering down the line, are the relevant committees here dealing with that, and do you have advice for them about what we do in the future?
Mr.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, certainly the future is a concern. There is the projections as they sit today indicate somewhere around 70 new patients every year. We do have a phase two bonding request that was on the table last year. It was not included in the governor's budget, but we did have some conversation about it. I believe the committee's actually toured the site. When we get into this 400-bed facility, it will be full by 2011. We are working with oversight committees on a variety of different initiatives to effectively and appropriately manage this population. In the civil commit programs across the country, I think it's fair to say that releases or reintegrations are few and far between. Having said that, I can tell you that we have one individual today that has made it all the way through the program and is in what we call a community preparation services program, which is located outside of the secure perimeter down at St. Peter. So we have one that's a step away from the community. We have a couple more that are in the pipeline that may get a positive recommendation. As you know, the law was changed last year that it's courts into this program now and courts out. So the courts make a decision. We have put together a clinical team that I think is among the best in the nation. I think that we have a treatment approach that is certainly consistent with best practices. I think that ultimately we may see some results of that, but again, it's really up to the patient to work his way through the program, and then it's a legal decision whether or not that person is prepared for release. So we work very closely with a number of different programs nationally. Primarily, I think some of you may have been with us when we went to Sand Ridge in Wisconsin. That program has been in operation for a number of years. Since 1996, they have reintegrated 60, about five a year. About 40% of them have found their way back to the program. We have to understand that this is a very challenging population to treat. And again, what we can do is put the best treatment components together. They have to be willing to participate. There are some, even today, that don't participate in treatment, but we're confident that we can manage it probably a little bit differently going forward than we have the last several years. Been a lot of turnover in clinical directors and directors of this program. There have been four clinical directors in the last 5 years, and about the same number of me. So there was a lot of growth. I think the program, at least we're seeing some stability with our executive team now, and hopefully we can manage it from that perspective. In addition to that, there have been some sentencing changes in the criminal code that may keep some sex offenders in corrections a bit longer. I think that there's an awful lot of attention being paid to this program, rightfully so. It is an expensive program because we are compelled to require treatment for everybody. This slide that I just threw up shows you where our per diem is at today. We're stating a per diem of $348 a day. Corrections is around $85 a day. By July 1, when we get into the new building, we'll be down to $315. And when that 400-bed facility is full, in today's dollars, it'll be around $285. When the second building is full, we'll be around $250. So you compare that to other states in the black at the lower portion of the graph, and you can see that we're going to be competitive in terms of the per diem. Now, the bad news is the budget has to grow quite a bit to get us to that per diem. But we're going to be right in the middle. We have a large program next to California. We have more civil commits than any state in the union. There are a couple, though, that are pretty close to us. Even Wisconsin is about 100 lower than Minnesota. But it is it's a new program across America. I believe there's around 20 programs nationally. Federal government has started a program. So this is a population that causes, I guess, a great deal of heartburn for all of us in terms of how can we safely manage this population and ensure public safety.
And, Mr. Chair, I think you were present at that tour when the Capital Investment Committee toured. And two bits
were at all of them, you know.
Yes, that's right. You were at all of them. The two things that I seem to remember from that time that have just stuck with me ever since, one is that no one has ever been released from the program in Moose Lake. I don't know if that, I sense that you were saying that is still the case. No one has ever been released from the program, and that some have been there since teens, but they have never committed a crime as an adult. But no one has ever been released. Would those still
Mr.
be...
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, we got that question a week ago from a legislator, and we're researching the issue of have committed no crimes. Well, I think the question was they have never been convicted of a crime. We do have...
Those who are there, who have been there since they were teens, since they're never released... They obviously wouldn't commit another crime.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, there are folks that we received as juveniles who have never been convicted of a felony as an adult. That is true. It's also true that in 12 years we have not released anyone. I think that now with the change in the release process, a new clinical team, and about 80% of the patients who are participating, we are cautiously optimistic that people will begin to at least move through the program. If they can convince the courts that they are prepared for release, they have a good release plan, we have a reintegration program that we've been working on that will supervise these people, unlike intensive supervised release. We'll do GPS, 4, 5, 6 face-to-face contacts a week, drive them to and from work. So we've got some things in place, including polygraphs upon release, aftercare programming, that I think are consistent with what seems to work around the country. So we're prepared for that first one hopefully will come to pass at some point, but that's not a decision that we make. I do have the question, too, Mr. Chair, to the bonding question. Mr. Biskins is not here, but it looks like it was $41 million for just the building. It did not, that did not include any ancillary services, no support space, just the 400-bed building. The price tag on phase two, which at some point we're going to have to discuss, is around $95 million. That includes program space, kitchen. We don't have any infrastructure, which is another problem up there. We're adding 400 beds with very, very little treatment space. It's something we can get by with for a while, but eventually we've got to get some of that supporting treatment space, a dining facility, medical facilities. We need a mental health component for this program, so there are some infrastructure pieces that will be included at such a point that we're prepared to present a phase two bonding proposal.
Representative Hausman, were you done with your question?
Just because you just mentioned the $90 million in future bonding that would be required because you're projecting numbers approaching 700 people there, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, this graph kind of gives you an idea of where we're at in terms of current beds are in black. The white bars are the DOC annex, two buildings from corrections. Yellow would be phase one, the building we hope to be into July 1. And then, as you can see, by late 2011, we're out of beds. So the robin's egg blue there is phase two bonding.
Okay, Representative Tamer. Representative Rukavina.
I'll bet you Representative Tolbert wish I had been later than I am. I'm the Deputy Commissioner. You know, members, every year it seems that the deficiency bill, the biggest amount of money, always seems to be within corrections, and I don't know, Commissioner, if I heard you right, but did you say as a percentage of our population or in actual numbers we're second to California?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Riccovina, that is, those are real numbers. That's not per capita. So we do have a wide net.
Mr. Chair, I think what he's talking about, Mr. Chair and Representative Riccovina, in this particular program, not the post-incarceration. Right.
Well,
Captain Rufino.
Chair, in this particular sex offender program, we're incarceration of all sex offenders.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riccovina, I think you missed our introduction. I wear a new hat now. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program under DHS. This is not corrections. There's a distinction. These are people who have been civilly committed, completed their criminal sentence. The courts have made a decision to civilly commit them. We have about 505 civil commits at these three locations. We have another 60 to 70 that kind of bounce between us and corrections because they're still under corrections authority. If they violate conditions of that release us, we can bounce them back to corrections. So there's about 66 that are dually committed to both us and corrections.
Mr. Chair, members, it is hard to follow the money because, you know, we've got corrections, we've got public safety, and we've got human services involved in incarceration in this state, and it is hard to follow the money, but Representative Houseman, good luck getting information, and I'm not reflecting this on Mr. Benson, but I asked Commissioner Fabian on the budget bill last year, because they were talking about violent criminals and how we had to keep their budget whole, which they're talking about again this year. And so I asked, well, violent criminals, so how many of those four DWI offenders have actually ever been, for DWI, ever been in a car accident? And she said, I'll get back to you. And 2 weeks went by, and she got back to me, and she told me, well, we're still trying to get the information. And then another week went by, and we were wrapping up the bill, and she said, we can't get you that information. Maybe somebody else can. And I asked House Research, and as of this November, I got a letter saying nobody can tell me that information. So you've got 668, I believe, or 88 people locked up in our prisons as felons for DWI, and the only reason they're there is because they drove a car under a certain amount of alcohol in their bloodstream, which we can argue whether that should be the number or not, but nobody can tell me if they've ever been in a car accident, which is the reason they're in jail. And so, again, maybe if we're the second highest in the country, maybe we're doing something right, but maybe we're doing something wrong. And when you've got people in jail being controlled by DPS and Commissioner Fabian, Department of Corrections, and now the Department of Health and Human Services, and we just keep building jails, maybe it's time to let some people out of jail. Because I only know of two anecdotal examples, and I have checked, and I have checked and found the answers to be true, and the only two people I know that are in jail as felons for 5 years in a DWI, only two people I know that are in jail that can prove it, that they've never ever been in an automobile accident in their life, not even a fender bender. Now, if these first people should be in jail, something's wrong with, it's not the land of the free and the home of the brave anymore. It's the land of the police and the home of the free. So something should be done here because every single year our deficiency bill is coming in here for people going to jail. And something's wrong. So, you know, Mr. Benson, it's not your fault, but maybe somebody could come forward with an idea about letting some people out of jail that shouldn't be there in the first place. Then we wouldn't need to build new prisons while we're cutting hospitals and nursing homes and K-12 and higher ed and everything else. There's my Representative Tamar, my speech again for this year before I vote against the criminal justice finance bill like I do every year since I've been here.
You voted for it last?
I know, because you didn't put anybody else in jail. It was the first time. I forget that. That's right. You talked me into it.
Let's see. We have Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Riccovina, this this program is exactly what you just said you wanted. We're letting people out of jail and putting them in a hospital.
Forever. Why don't you make a jail? It's just a jail, Representative Huntley. It's not, it's semantics. It's just a jail.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Rukavina, you ought to go look at the court cases and what the state said about whether this is a jail or a hospital.
Mr. Chairman, if I may correct Representative Rukavina on this, I want the record to be very clear that this is not a jail. This is a hospital.
With bars.
Mr. Chairman, it may be a secure hospital, but it is a hospital.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Benson? You and I met this morning, and I appreciate that. I got some information from one of our fiscal people after the meeting, and I'm not sure if you're the best person to answer this, but the Department of Corrections per diem rates at Moose Lake were $56.28 per day in 04. In 06, they grew to $63.23, and in 08, they're $84.08. Do you have any idea why that jump, or maybe with your new hat on, somebody else could comment on that, or if they can't today, I'd be interested in finding out what's driving that. During that period, the inmates dropped by 256, which is the number that we're talking about here, and yet the per diem rate took a fairly significant jump.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to corrections on that, but my guess would be they have 250 fewer offenders up there with relatively the same staff, because we're now renting two of those facilities. So that the economy of scale that they had when they had all of those offenders might have added to that. But like our facility, there's inflation in these places too.
Now maybe we can at some point in corrections get a little more information on that. Then I recognize your new hat, Representative Pittman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Benson. I think one of the things I would like to mention is, if you have further contracts coming along, that you can put in each contract that if there's a delay, that they cover the cost of the additional rent instead of us having to pick up when there's a construction delay. And want to highly recommend those kinds of things. I know that's water under the dam for this one. The other thing, though, is that if we cover this fully, Mr. Chairman, we're going to have to take this money out of somebody else. And I know we're in an unallotment status, so this is going to have to come out from something else. And Representative Rukavina, where else are we going to go for this? There's not many pleasant choices here. So I'm wondering whether we need to fully meet this, or if we can mitigate this in any way, because of it's got to come out from somebody else.
Mr. Chairman, let me answer the second part of your question, because I have that same concern. And I've asked point blankly, what would happen if this was delayed into the next fiscal year? And I know the Department of Finance, or I haven't got their new name down yet, I'm just an old duck on that, has indicated to me, and I've worked with them on this, that has to go this year. As I stated in my opening, there are others that will say, well, I want to be part of the deficiency too. And we've had an extremely rigid criteria for being able to have it as a deficiency bill. Now, you might want to ask Mr. Showalter, who is here, on the plan for the department to meet this particular deficiency. And the next one that may come up on March 3rd as well. But I would defer to, if you want that question asked, to talk to management and budget on that. If you'd like to have him, I'm sure he'll testify, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kessmeyer, would you like to hear a brief comment from
Mr. I think that would maybe be good.
Mr. Showalter, why don't you come up to the desk, and I think you heard the question, probably you were right behind Representative Kessmeyer.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is, for the record, is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director, and am at Minnesota Management and Budget. The question is how to fund this deficiency bill. As we all know, we had, at the last forecast, a negative balance in 2009. That was resolved through a series of unallotments to get us back to zero. The cost of this bill is being booked to the general fund. However, in the governor's budget, we are anticipating that there will be federal stimulus dollars that are available. A large chunk of the money will likely be retroactive to October 1 of 2008. As a result, we're not anticipating further unallotments or further needs to go and make additional cuts in order to fund this particular bill.
Well, Mr. Showalter, will we be able to use that money for corrections? Is that what you're saying? Or just to offset the cost from the general fund?
Mr. Chair, we're assuming that there will be a positive balance in 2009 when all is said and done.
So there's not a tie to corrections, just that the dollars come in?
Yes, sir.
Did that answer your question?
I don't know. It's Mr. Chairman, it opened up another one. If stimulus money is being used to cover, you know, safe operating expenses, how is it a stimulus?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think just broadly, certainly one of the major themes that states have been raising to Congress has been that since we balance our budgets on an annual or biennial basis, we will be making significant reductions in staffing and operating costs and other programs in order to pull things in line. And it is probably in the general economic interest to forestall at least some of those reductions or changes in the short term, because that's going to be a significant drag on the economy as in the upcoming quarters.
Mr. Chairman, the leading proponent of that program is Governor Crisp out of Florida.
Representative Meyer, you see them?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would say in large part, although the still the thing, though, is that in the future contracts, that building into the contract that if there's a delay...
Mr. Chairman, I think that deserves an answer.
I asked that very question this morning, actually, of
Mr. Benson,
and maybe you could comment on what was in the contract, and I don't know if you can comment about what your intent in the future is, but you indicated that the lawyers are working on it right now.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kipmeyer, yes, we have spent a lot of time with Department of Administration. As you know, it doesn't become our building until it's completed. It is in the hands of Department of Administration, but we are at the table with respect to trying to get this building completed in a more timely manner. We have been successful in getting that date cranked back from October 9th to April 30th. We hope to get possession of the building. The agreed-upon completion date, I believe, was March 9th or 11th, and there is a penalty clause in the contract that is currently being negotiated. There were other issues, as you can imagine, having bonded many millions of dollars over in corrections. There is always a reason why these things are delayed, and I never cease to be amazed, but there was bad soil up there. They did have an incredibly wet spring. They have lots of reasons that they will bring forward, but we are working very closely with the admin. They are have done, I think, an excellent job of trying to get this thing back on track. They have written several letters. They are negotiating with the construction company's attorney as we speak. So we have raised the bar in terms of trying to get this thing completed as quickly as we can so that we aren't incurring that additional rent expense.
Okay, Representative Rukavina.
Well, Chair, Members, Senator Showalter, you know, what it sounded like for the stimulus package in response to Representative Kipmeyer's statement that the governor's made a determination that we should keep people employed in the Department of Corrections with the stimulus package, but maybe not as... you know, the Penske system or the University of Minnesota. In fact, Representative Pawlowski, you're sitting across from me, but, you know, under the current proposal by the governor, Winona State either has to lay off 67 faculty or 88 staff because the governor says they can't raise tuition. So, you know, again, members and Mr. Benson and Representative Solberg, incidentally, Mr. Chair, I don't know why they got to ask corrections to tell you why the daily rates have gone up when it's a hospital and not a prison. So it seems to make my point that it is, that you got to ask directions why your daily costs are going up. But be that as it may, you know, I'd just as soon see us use the stimulus package then also to save jobs in Winona State and, you know, at the University of Minnesota, Duluth, Representative Huntley, rather than, and at the hospitals that get financing through your budget and match federal dollars that are going to disappear with this proposal. Let's keep everybody working now.
Mr. Chair.
Maybe the governor can do that.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. Just a response to Representative Riccobina and the Winona State. I would hope in your division, Representative Riccobina, that you would cut the Minsky Central office first before the campuses.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pawlowski, I'm going to make sure I put in law who's getting laid off and where there's going to be layoffs. But that doesn't address this point.
No, Mr. Chair, my point was just to, if we're going to start cutting, I think administrators in St. Paul, in an office that has ballooned to more than double its size in the last 10 years, should be cut before any campuses should be cut.
Maybe.
But that's a discussion for your committee.
Think,
and
yeah, I think
not
getting
the course
a
course.
Maybe administrators in every department should
and
be
I,
cut.
And I'm sure Representative Riccobina, under the circumstances, you'll do the best work possible.
Mr. Chairman, a point of direction, if I may.
I've got one more question, I think, Representative Broad, and then we will vote on the bill. So, did you want to...
Well, just a correction. I think the corrections per diem was a correction, and that doesn't is not there per diem.
My question was...
That's the correction, not just per diem.
And I did try to clarify that Mr. Benson Meyer may not have known the answer to that, being that it's now switched over to the Department of Human Services. I'll take some questions from Representative Broad, and then I think we'll renew the motion and vote on the bill. Representative Broad.
If I have questions specific to the bill, first question, I think Mr. Showalter may be best to answer. I'm curious how many departments have the ability to transfer their deficiencies from one year to another, or one fiscal year to another, as it sounds this agency was able to do. And then I have a second question for Representative Solberg. I'll just ask them both to be quicker. Related to, is there any provisions in your bill, or would you consider provisions in your bill that if the Department of Administration is able to secure some penalties, that those dollars don't, where do they go? Do they stay with the Department of Administration? Do they get pumped back in the general fund? Can we use any potential penalties to pay down what we're sending out to this agency today?
Maybe he can ask both of them. Mm-hmm. I was thinking the same question as here for the second one. I think it flows to the bond payments. I think is where it goes. But I said it is in a different pot of money. But I think that's the second. But let me have him clarify that.
We'll ask Mr. Showalter. He seems to be the one that may have the answer. Representative Scholler.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I'm more confident the answer to the first part of the question. I believe Representative Solberg is correct on the second part, since that actually comes back to the financing portion of the bond fund. As to the first part of transferability across years, in general, agencies do not have that ability. Operating dollars are allowed to carry forward between years in the biennium. In general, agencies are not able to carry back funding, which is in fact what Mr. Benson testified to earlier. That's due to specific statutory or rider language that's in the Human Services Bill. So generally, you will not see the ability to carry back appropriations. On occasion, you'll see carry forward language.
I think the one other exception may be financial aid for students, if I recall correctly.
And Mr. Chair, the second part, I think I'm correct in that it goes back to the bond, payments of the bond, because it's not in their possession yet. It's a bonding possession right at the present time. It will help our general fund or become, but it helps payment bond, the bond fund.
Okay, Representative Solberg renews his motion that House File 117, the deficiency funding provided for the Departments of Public Safety and Human Services be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We now have House File 10 before us. This one, in fact, the next two bills both went to Representative Junkie's Committee on Agricultural and Rural Economics and Veterans Affairs. So would you care to move the...
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Agricultural, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs Division Report for House File 10.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
And Mr. Chair, I'll now move House File 10 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, the motion is before us.
And Mr. Chair, then I have an amendment, the A1 amendment I would move, and I have some incorporations I'd like to put into that.
Okay, why don't you explain?
On the A1 amendment, members, just delete line 1.2, and then on line 1.5, change the 273.11 should be 273.111.
Okay, so that's a correction amendment to put the bill in the order.
Right.
That it's
and members, just
here.
So you know, we rarely see a revival. I thought it was interesting on here. It's a revival amendment. What we did last year was we had some repealers that you always see at the end of bills, and Representative Doty's bill here basically repeals last year's Green Acres action, but we don't want to repeal a repealer. The repealers were all right, so we're going to revive the repealer from last year's bill. Kind of interesting. I don't see that often here. So it's a revival bill, members, to correct.
Okay. So the amendment offered by House File 10 by Representative Junkie is before us. So any discussion? Technical.
What's the other thing? What were those things again?
Line 1.2, delete it.
Okay.
That's it. And 273.11 becomes 273.111 on line 1.5.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. If you could give us a brief overview of the bill and Mr. Doty, Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Junkie, for clearing up that unusual situation. If you have House File 10 before you, very quickly, this is a repealer of almost all of the changes that were made last year to the Green Acres program. The first section of the bill does allow the newly created Class 2B agricultural lands to continue. That new category was created last time, specified that it was not eligible for new enrollment in Green Acres. This would allow that to be continued to be in Green Acres, but it would also retain that category. It would also allow in that first section RIM program, CRP program, and other land enrolled in state and federal land conservation programs to be enrolled in Green Acres. That provision would also have gone down with the changes last year. Section 2 eliminates the directive to value land that was grandfathered into the Green Acres program because the grandfather provision would be repealed. 4 through 7, we are basically reinstating the income requirements that were previously part of Green Acres. Prior to 2008, at least one-third of the owner's total family income had to come from the land. Total production income from the land had to be at least $300 plus $10 a tillable acre, and it had to be devoted to the production for sale of agricultural products. Section 8 provides that land that was withdrawn from the Green Acres program since the end of the 2008 session could be re-enrolled in the program at the request of the owner, provided that it meets the requirements. And Section 9 is what the amendment dealt with. It is a revival, not a repealer of a repealer, because as we found out this past week, you can't do that. That's a brief summary of what this does. It is essentially a repeal with the intent to move forward to the Tax Committee with another bill that makes some of these changes so that they can sort things out.
And okay. I will are there any questions of Representative Doherty? Representative Tamar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Doherty, so what is, just so I didn't look it up in the statute book, what is Class 2A or 2B, or actually I should say, what is 2B that is the new language on Section 1? What category of land is this?
I believe the proper definition for 2B, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tamar, would be rural vacant land.
Rural vacant land. And this,
which would translate more understandably into non-productive farmland. We talk about productive and non-productive acres.
And Mr. Chair, is the repeal of this bill shifting taxes onto anyone else in the state? If we, what is the consequences of the bill, basically, is what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chair and Representative, of course, there's a shift. Anytime we reduce one property, somebody else is picking up the tab. What this does is take some of the load off of people. The intent is to take the load off of people who are not choosing to develop their land, lakeshore, river frontage, whatever, and not have that land taxed at its highest possible use, which is obviously development. And so, to the direct answer to your question is the other people in that taxing district would certainly be picking up the remainder of that bill.
And Mr. Chair, do we know what the cost of that shift might be?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, briefly here, I'll check out a page from the legislative auditor's report from last time. There's a couple of examples here. The estimated market value without green acres protection in, let's say, Twin Cities metro area per acre evaluation would be $10,453. The agricultural use value, $3,585. In the St. Cloud area, from $3,053 to $1,423. So from area to area, depending on the tax rates and evaluation situation in those areas, you'd see different reductions. But the significant reduction in the agricultural use value, the limited market value.
Representative Tamar.
Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Doherty, you said almost all, repealing almost all the changes that were made. Am I correct that the only thing that you're changing is this 2B, or did I miss something? You had, and when I say 2B, the rural vacant land. Can you just clarify without the whole thing, was there is something else that you're not changing back?
Representative Doherty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, as far as I can tell, looking through all those little T's and Q's, that is the only thing that's not repealed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, then I would take a little issue with the statement that development property is the highest and best use. 70% of Wright County was enrolled in Green Acres prior to these changes, and I would submit to you that there's very little development going on right now. Would this addition of rural vacant land, would that stop people in my district from cutting down stands of trees and plowing under wetlands in order to get within the definition of agricultural use as the assessor understands it to be since the changes were made last spring?
Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's the hope, that it would keep people from knocking down the shelter belts, tilling the, looking for the right word here, the...
wetlands.
The wetlands and the new buffer zones, that was what I was really looking for here, that we're trying to stop erosion, some of the newer things. That is the hope, yes.
All right. And
Representative Emmer.
I think that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Doty. One of the things that I noticed in our ads and for property many times is they will increase the property value because next door is an open space, or next door are woods, or next door is a park or something like that. So there's an intrinsic value that accrues to neighboring land when there is open space next door, such as what Green Acres often provides. Is it not also correct that in Washington County they tax other people in order to buy open spaces to create that? I think there's a value here to neighboring property as well that they benefit by having the Green Acres program. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I know that many people think that that's the right way to look at that. I know that there are others that think that developing it is the right way to look at it. I personally agree with you with that statement, but certainly I get, as the author of this bill, lobbied hard from people that think other directions too.
Okay, seeing no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Doty, help me understand the purpose of keeping the 2B classification. If both 2A and 2B are going to be treated the same, I don't quite understand why we're keeping this new classification in law unless we're setting something up for the future. And I don't know if that's the intent or what is the intent of keeping the 2B classification.
Representative Doty.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, the real name of this law is not Green Acres. It's the Minnesota Agricultural Property Tax Law, and there are many other things besides the Green Acres program that would be affected here, and it seems like that this division of property could be very useful, for example, in environmental protection down the future, in the future, or some other things. So, the reason for leaving it is that to make clear that that was one of the reasons that people were pulling their land out of this. And so if we leave those categories alone, allow them both in, I think we maintain protecting what we want to protect now and hopefully some more of that in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Doty, one of the concerns that I've heard is that assessors are confused as to which land to or which classification to put the land in, and that's been a big problem out there. Leaving the two classifications without any clarity and any changes in the classification continues that confusion, even though what you're doing, I think, treats them both the same. We're still left with the conundrum of subjective decisions on the classification themselves, and I'm wondering why we would do that and not simply delete it all and then have hearings and come up with a good law.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the situation where they would both be treated the same would only be in Green Acres. Other situations, I think, as I talk to assessors, yeah, they're not real fired up about the extra work of redoing agricultural land in these two categories because it is extra work, but they do talk about value down the road of being able to make this determination. So it's, I understand your point, but there are some reasons down the road where this could be valuable, and so that's the reason for leaving.
I think, we should remind folks that this bill has one very important stop yet before it would move forward, and that's the tax committee, which a lot of what's being discussed at this point will probably be discussed in that forum as well. So any further discussion?
Yes.
Representative Wagenius is next. Yeah.
Help me understand the relationship between the lands under this bill, the 2Bs, and easements. Say somebody has gotten a permanent easement on the land. Somebody else has paid them for an easement so that land would never be developed. I'm not understanding the relationship here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bovinius, nothing in the Green Acres program is permanent. It's as long as you continue to be enrolled in the program, you receive this property tax rate that is lower because you're being taxed at the lowest agricultural rate instead of the highest possible tax rate that that land could be used for. A program like RIM, for example, that's an actual easement attached to your deed so that you legally cannot do anything different would be a much different situation.
Representative Loganian.
Well, I'm not sure here. There are permanent easements and there are temporary easements. But I was looking at the permanent easements where somebody has already been given usually a fair amount of money to not develop the land. It does seem to me that they would also get this property tax reduction. And I'm not sure about that, but I'm trying to wrestle it out and I can't do it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. Under this situation, you would. And the rationale for that from those who think that's the right way to do it is that land, which if it's, for example, in the RIM program, is probably highly erodible, has significant environmental challenges, if you wish, that land could have been farmed, they could have been taking a lot more dollars per acre from it, and so taxing it at the value that they would have had with that is an extra incentive. There are many ways to look at this program.
The Representative, before I recognize a couple more people, and then we're going to have, because we've got one more bill, but it's my understanding that your bill would go back to OVAW, basically. And the bill that's before us next would rewrite the Green Acres laws, essentially the distinction here, which will then go to another committee before it would ultimately go to taxes as well.
Mr. Chair, that's a correct summary.
Representative Lynchewski. Oh, I thought you were indicating you wanted to. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then Representative Emmer, and then we'll vote.
Representative Doty, I think Representative Carlson actually kind of hit upon my question. I mean, there's all sorts of iterations of bills out there related to this issue, and yours is bringing us back to the way it was. And so I'm just wondering if you can tell the committee, and so we can argue successfully in the tax committee, why is yours better?
Representative
Doty. Mr. Chair, Representative Broad. Thank you for that. Mine's better because this is what my people told me to do back home. I stood in line at the assessor's office with my in-laws who farm and have much of their property in Green Acres, and they were about as confused with the notice as everybody else, and it was a fairly long line. And the consensus was very simple. Get rid of it. Here I am. Just get rid of it.
And we've all been there at some point under a similar circumstance, I'm sure.
Just a quick follow-up, and I appreciate your comment as we try to figure out what happened with that unfortunate change from last year. But how does this one differ from Representative David's bill? Is his very similar to yours?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I actually have not had line-by-line comparison. I would assume that anyone who asked the revisor's office to do a repealer probably ends up with the same language, so I'm sure it's similar. That's the best I can do without holding them up line by line.
Okay. Representative Emmer no longer has a question, so we will renew the Representative Lynchewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment as members kind of think through the Green Acres issue going forward, and we will have a long debate in taxes again, which we have for 3 years, contrary to people who feel that it's been done at the last minute. It was not. And I just want to remind members that most of the changes last year were in the 2007 tax bill as well that was vetoed. I remain puzzled as to why people think that there was not an open and transparent process. The Ag Policy Committee, the Tax Property Tax Committee, and the Tax Committee had hearings. Representative Junkie did a good job, I think, in this year's hearings, and I listened to both of them, and there was a lot of excellent testimony reminding people about all the public process that did happen. This is not an item that was done at the end in the tax bill. In fact, was put in more than one tax bill. But I do want to tell, you know, members here, there's kind of a problem with Representative Doty's bill here, and I don't want to be obstructionist. I don't support it. But I think it's okay to move it off to taxes for the debate to continue. Representative Junkie moved a couple out of his committee. There are, as Representative Broad has said, there are more, and there are many versions, and they are still coming in. I think we have 13 chief authors and about 50 co-authors. They're still pouring in. They're being referred to different committees. I think Representative Junkie's got a bunch more coming. So there's you know, still a lot of time to talk about this, but I do want to just point out a couple things, because I think when we continue to let the record be incorrect, then people keep believing it. So I just want to take this opportunity to state a few things that people could understand, not because we're going to solve it in this committee today, but we are in the end. What Representative Tamar said is right on. The repeal gave significant property tax relief to most Minnesotans. To just go back is a property tax increase to most Minnesotans. So I think Representative Diskins is right on the mark. If you just go back in time and say it's difficult and we're having a hard time, so let's just go back in time, you're just voting a property tax increase on the overwhelming majority of residents of Minnesota. And that is even the case in Wright counties. If 70% of the land is in green acres, it is still 90% of the residents of that county who are paying for that property tax relief. And we may decide that that's what we believe in and that we value that, and that's good. We may even want to add conservation land, which was never intended in law. But to say that there isn't a cost, I think, is just not accurate. And so people need to understand that there is not a state cost, but there is definitely a property tax shift, a significant property tax shift. So I also want to just mention that Representative Hansen, as the chair of the Audit Commission, did a fabulous job in hearing that item even before the tax committees and the ag people were even beginning to look at it. And if you go back and read the OLA report, I challenge any of you to think you shouldn't do something. I challenge anybody here of any political philosophy to read that report and say doing nothing is fine. It's not fine. It's a $35 million property tax shift. That to be a $55 million property tax shift in a few years. I don't think people are comfortable with that. And I think that Representative Junkie's committee has done a good job of trying to break the pieces down so there can be more decisions. And I do think that all committees with both parties are going to create a better product. But it's sort of like a bad story when you go back in time and see what happened with this issue. I do have to say some of our assessors are incredible people around the state and have done a great job. A number of them did not. A number of them passed along misinformation and didn't do their job and didn't want to do the hard work of assessing different kind of lands differently. And I don't think we should just give people a pass who aren't doing their jobs correctly. And the OLA report showed us that a whole bunch of stuff was going on wrong out there. We had counties like Representative Entrembus, who has carried a bill repeatedly, who wouldn't let people get brain acres who qualified. We have people getting it who shouldn't. And all of this is paid for by other Minnesotans. It isn't free. So I'm comfortable moving this on so we can continue the debate, but I don't want to leave the illusion with anyone that, and I don't think the chairs who've worked on this, like Representative Junkie, want to leave the illusion with anyone either. I can't speak with him, that we'll just go back in time. And just because people are mad, we'll dodge the bullet. And just because people are mad, we'll dodge the bullet and not make a tough decision. These are tough decisions. We get elected to take them. And there's a $35 million cost for this program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do have one other bill, and I'm just trying to think of the options. We should be out of here at noon, Representative Faust's bill. I think what we may have to do, Representative Faust, because I think yours is going to create much of the same kind of discussion, is reschedule your bill. I know Representative Aiken wants to hear it and was hoping it would be re-referred on Thursday. We may schedule another meeting, or we'll talk to Representative Aiken in terms of adjusting his schedule if that's workable as well. So you can leave if you'd like. Maybe you want to hear this discussion. We have a couple of hands that have gone up. Representative Rukavina and then Representative Kittmeyer. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, and you know, I'm supportive of this bill or Representative Faulk's bill, Representative Winchesky. Anytime you change any property tax laws, there's a shift. And this is $34 million. I recall a bill in 2001 where we shifted $200-some million to pay for transit, mass transit in the metro area a year, and we've never undone that shift. That cost $200-plus million, almost $300 million, if I'm not mistaken, so people can have buses. We had a shift, what's become a shift, I think, in the K-12 spending bill, where district after district after district has to go to excess levy. Because we had about an $800 million cost in the property taxes in the 2001 K-12 takeover, and we've never gone back to look at that $800 million cost here. And you know, as chair of the tax committee, I think it changed before you got here, that there used to be three tiers of taxing homes in Minnesota that was kind of based on a progressive type system, and we've now rolled all those homes into one tier. Well, I think there's two, excuse me, and that cost and shifted a lot. And when we did the utility rates and the other apartment shifts that you were part of, that cost shifted a lot of taxes onto homeowners at the, you know, it helped out apartment owners, and there's absolutely no indication that anybody's apartment went down, the rent went down in it, but it was a shift of probably hundreds of millions of dollars again. So we do it all the time. This is probably the cheapest shift I've seen. Whether it's good tax policy, I guess, you know, one person's pork is another person's bacon. So, you know, it's a matter of opinion.
Hey, Representative Kittmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think, too, and I recall to what I've heard and sometimes the comments made, but probably the biggest thing was the fact that the word grandfathering was used, and it wasn't grandfathering. It changed the term drastically, but the word was used grandfathering. And so there's a lot of folks who had this sense of the usual term of grandfathering, and that definition was changed drastically, unlike any other bill usually has been done, common understanding of it. And I think that created, as people became aware of that drastic situation, that has fueled it. And I think it's also a matter of coming into a program and going out of a program or a choice. But the grandfathering, I think, was a big term that created a lot of, and I think reasonably so, very, very, very much so, consternation in regards to our regular citizens. So, Mr. Chairman, I do support this being moved on and do look forward to continued discussion. It certainly has been instructive and helpful. Thank you.
I'm going to recognize Representative Emmer, and then we're going to vote because we do have to be out of here by noon. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just respond to the comments. Well, I appreciate everybody's attempt to try and solve what they believe is an inequity. You've created one that, and we can quibble all day long about the process. I don't want to do that. We're going to have a different perspective on the process regardless of how you want to view it. You've got your viewpoint, Representative Linchesky, about how this was handled. I see it laid out in black and white. Clearly, the process wasn't appropriate when you've got people from all over the state who got notice last fall of something that was significant that was going to happen to them. And the result was it's even worse than the transit example, Representative Rukavina, because we're talking about people's real property. We're talking about their way of life. And I'll speak for Wright County because that's where I'm at. Basically, what this change did, and I will stand by the 11th hour nature of it, even though I know you had discussions for many months, when we're on the House floor and we're passing that final tax bill and there are amendments where we're talking about the serious far-reaching implications of changing the definitions of agricultural use, and nobody's listening. No, everybody is
busy with the overall topic, which was an important one, I know. But now you find out a few months later, when people are not talking about paying more taxes, they're talking about losing their land. Basically, what this change has done to many families, and I know you can point at the developer here and there, but that's why I took issue with Representative Doty, because development's at a standstill. I mean, it's got to hold the property for 7 years before you can qualify for the tax classification anyway. So the issue is one of open spaces. It's quality of life. You've got people out there who, and to blame it on some assessors, or to suggest that some assessors are to blame because they're supposed to be separating out a wetland or a slough from other uses of the property. Essentially what this has done in its most broadest form is it's a taking of property, because people can't afford the tax classification that they're getting right now. And you know what the result is? The result is that they have to sell, and then stands of trees, property that's been put into non-productive use, but just because you let a field lay fallow for a year or two doesn't mean it's not agricultural. You're basically encouraging development and spread of residential or higher density type uses, and I think that's inappropriate. But more importantly, it's the taking. And I'd invite you to come out to Wright County, and we'll have a couple of meetings with folks that have been impacted, because they were under a certain set of rules. And I understand you call it a shift going back, but remember, those rules existed for a long time, and that's what they operated under. At least it could have been a more gradual education process if there truly was a need for this type of change instead of the dramatic change. And I thank Representative Doty and anybody else who brings forward a revival statute at this point, so we can have that discussion.
Okay, we're going to be voting, and this discussion, as I mentioned earlier, will continue on in the Tax Committee, and then we do have the House bill that will be before us as well. So Representative Junkie renews his motion that House File 10 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. What we're going to do, as I mentioned earlier, members, I will visit with Representative Aiken, who is trying to get the South bill up, I think, next week, and see what kind of adjustment we may or may not be able to make. And if we can't, watch your emails, because we might reschedule finance sometime Tuesday, Wednesday, so we can get it to the House floor if need be on the South bill. So with that, thank you, and meeting adjourned.